Shikasta by Vandana Singh. Narrated by Vikas Adam, Catherine Ho, and Sneha Martin.
Chirag, this is the first time I am speaking to you, aloud, since you died. I've learned by now that joy is of two kinds, the easy, mindless sort, and the kind that is earned hard, squeezed from suffering like blood from a stone. All my life I wanted my mother to see her son rise beyond the desert of deprivations that was our life. She wanted me to be a powerful man, respected by society. But so much of what she saw were my struggles, my desperation. So when the impossible happened, when our brave little craft was launched, the first crowd-funded spacecraft to seek another world, the unexpected shock of joy took her from illness to death in a matter of months. She died smiling. You remember her slight smile? You were always asking why she didn't let herself smile more broadly, laugh out loud. Auntie, you'd say, smile. That made her laugh, reluctantly. You were always pushing at limits, including those we impose on ourselves. For months after you were killed, I would wake up in the morning, wondering how I was going to live. But we kept going. Your absence, a U-shaped space, was almost as tangible as your presence had been. And now, nearly 12 years later, we celebrate in your name the arrival of our spacecraft on another world. A homemade makeshift craft, constructed on the cheap with recycled materials by a bunch of scientists and scholars from the lowest rungs of a world in turmoil, headed to a planet that of all the nearby habitable worlds had the least chance of finding life. It was soon after the time of launch, over a decade ago, that our moment of fame got eclipsed. The world's mega space agencies' combined efforts found life on Europa. Suddenly, ice algae were the thing. 6 years ago, the discovery of complex life on the waterworld of Gliese 1214b had the international press in a frenzy. Those of us who had dreamed up our space mission and made of the dream a reality were forgotten, and almost forgot ourselves. The wars and the global refugee crises took their toll. Now the first signals from our planet have catapulted us once more into public view, although some of the news reporting is critical. Why spend so much time and effort on a planet like Shikasta 464b when the water worlds appear to be teeming with life? Yes, Shikasta 464b is a lot closer, about 4 light-years away, but it is a hell of fire and ice. A poor candidate for life. But we are dreamers. We want to think beyond boundaries, to find life as we don't know it. You helped me see that I could be more than I'd imagined. You took my bitter memories of classmates laughing at my poor English, my ignorance, my second-hand clothes, and gave me, instead, Premchand and Ambedkar, Khusrau and Kalidasa. You taught me that a scientist could also be a poet. So we are making this recording for you and for posterity. Sometimes I practice a game I used to play when I was younger. I pretend to be an alien newly arrived on Earth, and I look at Delhi with new eyes. The dust-laden acacia trees outside the windows, the arid scrubland falling away, the ancient boulders of the Aravali Hills upon which the squat brick buildings of the university perch like sleeping animals. In the room is the rattle of the air conditioner, the banks of computer monitors, that slender, dark woman in the hemisphere. She is here, and she is not here. She is in this room, the modest control room for the mission, and she is 4 light-years away with her proxy self, the robot you and I named Avinash, or Avi for short. She is Avi. Despite the light delay time, she is there now, on that hellish world. The Immer's opacity clears, and I can see her face. For just a moment, her eyes are alien, unfocused, as though she does not see me. What does she see? If I speak to her, she will become the Kranti I know. But before that, she is, for just that moment, a stranger.
Kranti, I will describe the planet to you because you will never see it through Avi's eyes. It is a violent place. Imagine a world so close to its sun that they face each other like dancing partners. That's how Annie first described it to me when her group found it. The light curve signature was subtle, but it was there. Shikasta 464's only known planet, a not-so-hot Jupiter, had a tiny sibling. Two Earth masses, a rocky world too close to its sun to be in the habitable zone, but between its burning dayside and the frozen night, there was the Terminator, the boundary. Nobody actually believed we would get there. I say we, but really I mean the spacecraft, the Rohit Vemula. How hard were those early years? Now we have our reward. The signals, first from the spacecraft and then from Avi. I can see through his eyes, as you should have been doing right now. I know what he knows, even though the knowledge is more than 4 years old. My grandfather is in Bhubaneswar, celebrating with palm beer. He says that because I am a kind of famous person now, all will work out for our people. But I know, and he knows, it is not that simple. From faraway Arizona, Annie is looking at the pictures on her screen. The substellar side of the planet, always facing its dim red star, is all lava seas. But in the Terminator, what you call the Twilight Zone, the temperatures are less extreme and the terrain is solid rock. For this reason, you and Chirag designed our proxy to be a small, flat climbing robot with very short legs. There he is, up on the cliff face like a crab. I'm used to boundaries. Ever since my exile from my people's ancestral home, I have lived in in-between places. Living on a boundary? You know you don't belong anywhere. But it is also a place of so much possibility. Through Avi's eyes, the planet's Terminator has become more and more familiar.
Annie. For my people, the number four is sacred, four directions, four holy mountains. It always felt right to me that this project began with the four of us on a rock, stargazing. We're still figuring out what it means to be together again after all this time, without you. Let me begin with the old question. How do you know when something is alive? I grew up on the rez. Red dust and red rock, mesas and buttes against the whitest sky you've ever seen. I grew up lying on boulders with my cousins, watching the constellations move across the sky, and the stars seemed close enough to touch. During the winter, when the snow still fell, we little ones would huddle inside the hogan, listening to our elders tell the stories of how Coyote placed the stars in the sky. My plump fingers would fumble as I tried to follow my grandmother's hands, deftly working the string patterns. With one flick of the wrist, one long pull, one constellation would turn into another. The cosmos was always a part of our lives. Even in the hogan, there was Mother Earth, Father Sky. Now we live in boxes like white people. My uncle is a retired professor and a medicine man. He says our rituals and ceremonies keep us reminded of these great truths, even in this terrible time for our people. Growing up, I thought I'd follow his footsteps. My Uncle Joe, the professor of future studies at Diné University. But I took freshman geology to fulfill a science requirement and ended up hooked. I remembered the first time I realized that I could read the history of the earth in the shapes and striations of the rocks, the mesas, and the canyons. I ended up going to the state university as a geology major, hoping to do something for the Navajo economy, which relied at that time on mining operations. I was naive then. Luckily, I got distracted by exoplanet atmospheres, late-night homework sessions, too much coffee, my boyfriend at the time. So here I am, planet hunter, all these years later, looking for biosignatures in exoplanets. I've been looking at the images and puzzling over a few things. After several thousand exoplanets, we still don't really understand how planetary atmospheres originate. Earth is such a special case that it only tells us of one narrow band of possibilities. With the exception of the noble gases, nearly all the gases in our atmosphere are made by life. I'm thinking about my grandmother's story of the holy wind. Life is breath. Breath is life. Literally and in every other way. Shikasta 464b is too close to its star to do more than graze its habitable zone, which is why it is last on everybody's list for habitability. But my argument is that A, the thin atmosphere, only 0.6 ATM, is nevertheless more than what we'd expect of a planet that ought to have lost much of its atmosphere long ago. So what's causing it to persist? Could be geology. Could be life. And B, the terminator between the magma pools of the dayside and the frozen desert of the nightside is actually relatively temperate in places with temperatures that might allow for liquid water. There are trace amounts of water vapor in the upper atmosphere, but let's not get excited. Likely not enough to create oxygen by photolysis. Nah, if you want an oxygen atmosphere, you have to look elsewhere. There is hydrogen, methane, and carbon dioxide, but that is hardly surprising on a world with active geology. So, Cronti and I have been going back and forth about how we would actually know something is alive. We decided that since we both come from tribal cultures, we should ask our elders the question. My Uncle Joe, who is Hatachi, says that life is a property arising from connectedness. The universe, being whole, is therefore alive. Don't dissect things so much, he says, professor and medicine man all at once. See the entirety of things first. It is only through the whole that the parts come into being. Cronti's grandfather comes of a hill people of lush tropical forests. They call themselves the people of the waters, and he says that rocks, stones, and mountains are alive. They are gods. Anyway, getting back to the point about the Terminator. All those years ago, some of us broached the idea that there are worlds where life is, A, different from what we recognize as life, B, not widespread over the planet. In fact, the planet might well have only a few habitable regions on it, and C. It is theoretically possible to find pocket regions even in such inhospitable places as Shikasta 464b, where some kind of life thrives, and D. That life could well be complex life if the pocket habitats are, despite the name, deep enough, large enough. Last long enough to have these forms of life evolve. Which is one reason I like red dwarfs. Shikasta 464 is a beauty, brighter and heavier than average, but still a red dwarf. Small, resilient, and very, very long-lived, as I too hope to be. Long-lived enough to up the possibility of life on one of its planets, I hope. Our little rock is quite a mystery. It shouldn't have as much atmosphere as it does, tenuous though it is. Considering how close it is to its star, the solar wind ought to have stripped much of it away. Plus, The frozen antistellar side is so cold that some of the gases in the atmosphere should have rained out as snow. So why so much atmosphere? Perhaps outgassing. Shikasta B is a happening place, lots of active geological processes churning up the surface. But our models don't give us the numbers we need. So, life? I like it when we are surprised by the universe.
Chirag. It began from a single discussion in a certain university in Delhi. The four of us, Annie, Kranti, myself, and you, talked all night. You were witness to the great shaking up of civilization in the 2020s, the wars and civil strife, the wave upon wave of refugees fleeing the boggy, unstable tundras, the unbearable heat of the tropics. You saw the anoxic dead zones of the ocean. You hung the I can't breathe banners over the bodies of the refugees floating among the silvery carcasses of dead fish, the photograph that made you briefly famous. From the shaking of the world arose little groups that came together the way sand gathers in the nodes of a banging drum. Fiery intellectuals and dispossessed tribals, starving farmers and failed businessmen. We saw it grow. Little groups around the world, islets of resistance, birthplaces of alternate visions, some of which became the solidarity circles from which our dreams emerged. We witnessed the collapse of things as we knew them, saw the great world machine sink to its steel and chromium knees, threatening to drag us all down with it. We saw the paradox of life carrying on through the mayhem, in the big cities and small towns, even as our peoples fought the killing machines all around the globe, the small rituals of breakfast on the table, sleepovers for one's children, bringing your lover chocolates on her birthday. It was a mad idea, in the midst of all this, to dream up a crowd-funded cheap space program, to send an experimental robot as explorer on another world. So many friends left us in outrage, accusing us of turning our backs on the real struggles. Those of us who remained launched the worldwide solidarity circles, the crowdfunding. Dissent was the spice and oil that moved us forward. The circles formed offshoots, generated ripples of their own. They birthed art movements, films, new university departments, even the growth of independent city-states around the globe. As long-existing boundaries wavered and reformed. Then, during the spacecraft's journey, we scattered, were lost, some claimed by strife, others by the sweeping pandemics of the last decade. It is a miracle, then, that some of us have been able to return to the project, now that the signals are coming in thick and fast. But of the four of us who first talked the whole thing into being, that night on the boulder under the unusually clear Delhi sky, only you have not come back. You gave yourself to this perhaps more than any of us, and then you were taken down, flung back into the earth from which you rose. I can still see your hands caressing the chassis that was to be Avi, muttering your strange AI spells, the grin lighting up your face as the robot came alive. You had no defense against the pain the world inflicted on us. You were Annie's uncle dying of radiation poisoning in the Navajo desert. You were Kranti's younger cousin shot by the police. You were my newborn sister laid outside a school in the hope that someone could feed her. Ultimately, they came for you. And you knew in that moment what it was to be all the peoples of the world who have lived in hell. Each time I think of what you must have gone through, I die with you and for you. And I live for you, again and again. I live for what the four of us represent. We are the idea of the destruction of caste, class, and race come alive. Together we are walking alternate paradigms, irrefutable counter-arguments to the propaganda of the powerful, to the way of life that is accepted as the norm. We live in dangerous times, and because people like us threaten the established order, we are dangerous. And therefore, in danger. I don't really know who the men are who guard us, but it is part of SR's promise to me. Essar approached me himself with the offer of protection for our project. Accepting it made me feel uncomfortable because his god is money. Money, he says, is what will set Dalits free, and indeed, it has freed him. So much that he can walk the streets, that's a euphemism for his armored car, surrounded by bodyguards and impunity. I'm grateful for his protection and for his support, although we only took a small fraction of what he offered. But his is not the kind of freedom I seek. I am uncomfortable around power, I suppose. Or maybe I am more of an idealist than I admit to Kranti and Annie. You see, I remember what it was like when I was a child. Before we came to Delhi, my mother cleaned houses in Patna. She always pushed me to go to school, and she would ask me to repeat my lessons to her in the evenings so she could learn to read too. I remember her repeating the letters after me, and sometimes she would be so tired, she would fall asleep before I had finished. Once, when I came home crying because the teacher had pushed me to the back of the class for being a Dalit, she told me why she had named me Chirag. I remember her eyes burning in her face, saying, "In the darkness of my life, you are the light. What use is suffering if it doesn't make you stronger?" Much later, I came across the poetry of Om Prakash Valmiki, who could have been speaking in my mother's voice. Here's how I translated his words for Annie. "That wound of the hammer blow on the rock births sparks." That night in Delhi, we started thinking about how we would explore space and why. We were in a climate funk. The West Antarctic ice shelf had collapsed faster than predicted. Sea walls had been breached in Miami and Mumbai and Boston. Fish were swimming in the streets of Kolkata. We'd thought to escape from grim reality by going to a movie, but they showed one from the tweens that pissed us off, called Interstellar. Lying on the cooling rock, you said suddenly, "Trash, burn and leave." "Yeah, I'm going to be a space colonizer now. That's my motto. Having fucked up the only world we have, I'm going into space to fuck up a few more." You laughed bitterly and started singing, "Trash, burn and leave," to the tune of some pop number I don't even remember. "Shut up," said Kranti and Annie together. "Or at least sing in tune," I said. We laughed, drank a little more, and wept a little too. That was the start of one of those passionate discussions you have in college that goes on all night. How would we, those on the other side of colonization, do it differently? We couldn't have known then that the answer to the question would take our whole lives. We look for life on other worlds because we want to deepen what we mean by human, what we mean by earthling. As our own atmospheric and oceanic oxygen levels fall and species go extinct like candles winking out year after year, we want to bring attention to the wonder that is life, here and elsewhere. It is an extension of our empathy, our biophilia. Build your approach, your business model, your way of thinking around that paradigm, and you've already built in respect for every human, regardless of race or class or caste, connection between all life, and an enhancement of the collective human spirit. Back in the early years of the 21st century, one of my people, Rohit Vemula, was driven to sacrifice his life for a vision of a better world. I had suffered from depression for some of my college years, and in the days following that first late-night conversation, I reread what he had written before he died, how he'd wanted to go to the stars. It felt as though he was speaking to me across time and history, urging me to live and dream, reminding me who I was, a glorious thing made of stardust. "I can live for this," I told myself that night. Now I wish I could tell him. Brother, you did it. You took us to the stars.
Kranti. I've been spending more and more time exploring Shikasta B. Chirag tells me that it is not wise to spend so much time immersed, but I can't help it. When I'm in the immersphere, I feel all relaxed. All tension goes away. I explore the twilight zone in Avi's little body, sampling data. It is becoming a place to me. Every night we look at the images, locate features on a grid, and name things. Here's the description Annie posted on our Citizen Science website. Shikasta B's sky is clear and filled with stars. Looking sunward, the star Shikasta 464 is a dull red sphere, bathing the planet with its inadequate light. Most of its radiation is in the infrared. Avi is standing at the eastern edge of the Terminator, atop a cliff some 10 kilometers high. The view of the dayside is spectacular. Here, the ground falls away in sheer vertical walls down to a redly glowing plain, where large pools of magma, hundreds of kilometers across, are connected by lava rivers. Near the cooler Terminator region, the surface lava in the pools crusts over, and enormous bubbles of noxious gases break through it at irregular intervals, popping like firecrackers that would be louder if the planet had much of an atmosphere. Fine droplets of molten rock rain down from these explosions. Behind Avi, the top of the levee is a cracked and fissured plain, dark and shadowed, with a few odd rock formations. On the night side, the images beamed from our orbiting satellite show a frozen terrain cut through by fissures and canyons on a much larger scale. Perhaps deep in the cracks, tidal friction from the interior warms the place enough for life to have a tenuous hold. We don't know yet, but the Terminator between the two extremes is our best bet. Today, Avi has begun exploring a small canyon that we have named Shiprock. It is a maze of narrow gullies between jagged rock walls about 40 meters in height. Avi has already mapped it from the air. Now he's methodically mapping details from the surface level, moving up the walls, along the canyon, poking his antennae into holes and cracks. I am remembering, as I clamber up and down the terrain with him, the time I spent with my grandfather during summer holidays in my final year of college. He had returned to our tribal lands the year before. The refinery had ruined the land in the 20 years of his exile, and now the mining company wanted to extend the open-cast mines. My grandfather's village, my people, were all scattered by the initial displacement, but they had come together to fight for their land. The police brought the company gundas with them, looking for the agitation leaders. This is what they call an encounter killing. Cold-blooded murder that is reported as a killing in self-defense. Four people, including my cousin brother Biru, were killed the week before I arrived. I can't talk about it still. I have been insulated from the troubles of my people for so long, because my mother took us children away when the refinery displaced us. Most of my childhood was spent in Bhubaneswar. I was good at studies, so she got me admitted to a corporation school, even though my grandfather was against it. They had such arguments. But my mother won. She had seen too much violence and death in the war against our people. She wanted me to be safe, to get a modern education. My grandfather didn't speak to her for 3 years. And then he was forced to come to Bhubaneswar to find work. It proved my mother's point, that we could no longer live the way we had for thousands of years, so why fight and be killed? When she realized my grandfather was still active in the struggle, she shook her head and said he was a fool. I never paid attention to all that, only to my studies. Only when I went to Delhi for university, I realized what it meant to be Adivasi. I was so integrated into modern life that I had forgotten my native language and customs. But with my black skin and different features, I was seen as backward, someone who had come to a top university because of the reservation system. I joined an Adivasi resistance group and slowly began to unlearn the corporation propaganda and learn again the language and history of my people. That summer, I went back to Odisha to see my grandfather. I still remembered the green hills and the clouds that would sit on top of them, and the plain, which used to be crisscrossed by small rivers and streams. But so much had changed. I stood in the dust and heat of the foothills and hugged my weeping aunt as the bodies of the jungly terrorists lay before us. Biru lay on his side as though sleeping. Blood had seeped from the gunshot wound on his head into the ground. That day, I understood for the first time the reality of being on the receiving side of genocide. In the terrible days that followed the raid, our relatives, the hill tribes, hid us from the police. I went with the fugitives into the cloud forest. The narrow trails were filled with the calls of unfamiliar birds and beasts. Up there, under the shadow of the mountain god, eating wild mangoes from the trees while a light rain fell, I had a strange experience. Belonging. I looked at my grandfather's face, lined and seamed from decades of suffering, and laughing so defiantly despite all our sorrows, and I finally understood why he fought for what was left of our home. In those days, my head was filled with all kinds of grand ideas. I was a budding intellectual. All the worlds of knowledge were opening before me. I was writing a thesis on extensions of Walker indices, which are a set of parameters that try to tell how alive something is, from a rock to a mountain goat. My grandfather was proud of me and always wanted to know what I was studying. In his village, he had been a man of wisdom and power. In the city, he was an activist by night and a gardener for hire by day. But he was the one who taught me to see in a different way. My vague idea of semiotics grew sharper and more vivid during that time in the forest. I didn't put it all together until some years later in my first academic paper, but what the forest taught me was that nature speaks, that living and non-living communicate with each other through a system older than language. In fact, physical law is only a subset of the ways in which matter talks to matter. When my grandfather went foraging for medicinal plants for the injured people, I saw him come alive to all the life around him. I had never seen him like that. I realized there is a way of being alive that we have lost by becoming civilized. I published my first paper in my final year, a very technical one on extensions of Conian semiotic theory, but the basic ideas, they all come from that trip. What I'm trying to do now, immersing myself in this alien environment, is because of those long-ago forest treks with my grandfather. Whenever I used to ask him how he knew something about the forest, he would say that he just paid attention. At first, I used to get irritated. Now I understand better what he meant. He practices a kind of radical observation in which he opens all his senses to information flow without preconceptions and simply waits until something crystallizes. This sounds ridiculous to Chirag, just the kind of mumbo-jumbo that people associate with the mystical savage. But I think this radical, unfiltered immersion can lead to alternative ways of understanding the world. For example, all the emerging discoveries of animal language, the monkey species in Australia, the bowhead whale in the Arctic, the scientists in each case spent so much time with the animals, getting to know them, listening to their recordings day and night. That is what I am doing here on Shikasta B. And I want to understand Avi, whose Walker Index is 7.8, in between life and non-life. This is the first time he has been on active assignment in an alien world. He can learn. On an AI scale, he is a genius. In what ways will Shikasta B change him?
Annie, this radical observation thing of Kranti's, as she says, it's nothing new. Indigenous people have been practicing it for millennia. She was afraid Chirag would scoff, but I think she has a point. She thinks we should go even deeper. Let's tell ourselves Shikasta B's stories, she said, stories about this place. Maybe in assuming everything is alive and giving each thing a certain agency, different degrees of aliveness will become apparent. What she's saying, I think, is that if you are looking for a pattern and don't know what it is, it makes sense to invent patterns of your own semi-randomly. This Monte Carlo-like shaking up of patterns and paradigms can throw up notions that you might not have reached through logic alone. This goes against conventional wisdom, which says, hey, we humans like patterns, so beware. The patterns we find are likely simply in our heads, as opposed to real patterns. The thing is, when it comes to real, what we recognize as patterns and connections are neither purely cultural or anthropomorphic, nor purely natural. As Kranti says, what is culture but a specific kind of contextualizing with the rest of one's environment? Well, it could all be a waste of time. But we have that time, I mean. What's to lose? Actually, Chirag didn't scoff when we suggested it. He was about to. I know the signs well, the way his left eyebrow starts going up and the deep sigh. But his poetic side saw an opportunity. It was funny how his face changed. You could see that internal struggle. He has declared himself the official scribe, collecting our story ideas and rewriting them. Once there was a planet too close to its star. They shared a vast and complex magnetic field, and their proximity made a beautiful world of extremes separated by a circular boundary. In the boundary world, it was neither too hot nor too cold, but it was always windy. Various species of hot beings lived on the dayside, and they wanted to know what it was like on the other side of the world, where the star's heat and light did not fall. So the forces that shaped them, heat and pressure and magnetic forces, turned them into huge molten balls that rose from the lava seas and were flung at the sheer walls of the boundary, where they fell apart, crashing back down into the molten ocean. But the tiniest of them cooled and solidified into lava dust motes and were able to ride the wind. The Great Eastern Highlands, where Avi is exploring, is my favorite place on this planet. Imagine looking down into magma pools of hell from such a height. I've never had vertigo, spent most of my childhood clambering up cliffs. But the vids from the edge of the Great Levee make me nervous and excited. I can hear the wind blowing at Avi's back, a constant dull, muted roar, the cold surface current from the frozen nightside. Higher up, hot air from the substellar side swirls in the opposite direction. We've gridded off the Highland Plateau on top of the levee. The dramatic temperature difference at the terminator makes for a fissured, tortured landscape. Lots of crevasses, passageways, mazes, all bathed by the dim, angry, grazing light from the red dwarf star. Avi has made progress on his ground-based survey of Shiprock Canyon, which winds between sheer basalt walls on the plateau. His headlights reveal a maze of passageways, rocky arches, and bridges. At first, I thought there was something wrong with his optics, because when he looked up, the stars didn't look so clear at about 30 degrees around the zenith. Dust? The atmosphere is very thin, but I can imagine solidified lava bits from the molten rock fountains in the plains below being swirled around by the wind. Could there be dust devils on Shikasta B? Kranti's message read. And as I sipped my coffee in the glowing sunrise of the high Arizona desert and looked at the newest image, I thought, Nilchi. I remember my grandmother explaining to me when I was very little that the whorls on my finger pads and the little vortex of hair on my head were signs of the holy wind that animates us. There's Nilchi on another world, raising dust into a vortex, making this being, this dusty woman. Now that I know what to look for, I can see her form, faint but discernible against the backdrop of rock and sky, a dust devil composed of lava dust. She is whirling along the canyon like a live thing. Dusty Woman danced through the narrow passageways of Shiprock Canyon, shaking her skirts and looking into the caves and hollows. Who is tugging at my skirts? But the wind took her voice away, and when it died, she had to lay down to rest and wait until the wind picked her up again. Kranti is making up a story about Saguaro, a creature that lives in the fissures and passageways of Shiprock Canyon. Chirag declares we are silly, but has joined the fun. His contribution is balls of fire, the semi-solid glowing lava balls that are sometimes hurled up from the magma pools, hitting the levee wall with a splosh. We also came up with Lindy Motes, after my sister Lindy, for the little solid bits of lava that are blown over the magma pools toward the great cliffs. These have left their mark on the tops of the canyon walls, which have been roughened over millennia of constant battering by these windborne particles. You should see Avi scuttle after the Lindy Motes like a little dog. He's been doing some odd little dancing steps. There's something we can't yet see or sense that he can. It occurred to me that we should plot his movements, just in case they give us some kind of clue. Avi's certainly been behaving weirdly. I wish you were here to see this, because more than anything, he is your baby. Our pictures are being analyzed the world over by scientists and amateurs and nutcases via our Citizen Science Initiative. We hope someone will find something. But the far more exciting pictures from a major mission to a water world are eclipsing ours, as is, need I mention, the latest cluster of wars. Still, we have some traffic. When we discover something, it immediately goes to our site, becomes global and public. Our reports are clear and contextual. They lack the aloofness of scientific papers, but they're plenty rigorous. Then the world gets to dissect, shred, and analyze what we have to say. Like our finances, everything is public, everything is transparent. I like to think we are changing the culture of science from the margins, a fringe bunch of scholar activists in little circles around the world. I've realized after all these years that what's bothered me about Western science is that there is no responsibility, no reciprocity. You just have to be curious and work hard and be smart enough to discover something interesting. The things you discover, you have no relation to, no responsibility for, except through some kind of claim-staking. I grew up in two worlds, the world of conventional science and the world of the Navajo. I used to think there was an insurmountable wall between them. But looking through Avi's eyes, I'm beginning to see whole. I'm feeling more complete. Of course, there really is no such thing as a complete person. That's another Western concept, isn't it? We are open systems. We eat, we excrete, we interdepend. We feel your absence like a three-legged chair.
Chirag, the Lindy Motes did not belong here. They had been forged in the lava beds, and here it was cold, so cold. Some of them were swept by the currents past the great cliffs of the boundary into the fabled nightside, where they nucleated tiny snowflakes as gases condensed around them, snowing on the frigid, tortured landscape. But others managed to stay in the boundary lands. Flung against the canyon walls, they left their tiny footprints on the surface, only to slide down into sheltered gullies. Here they found that the wind was not as strong, and they could perceive the twists and turns of invisible pathways, magnetic field lines. They felt the pull and tug of these, and aligned themselves so. The invisible pathways changed, sometimes slowly, sometimes at random, but the Lindy motes followed them like little flocks of sheep across a meadow. I know metals and money. I went into metallurgy because I wanted to see if there was a way around extractive industries like mining. And I went into money because I wanted to kill that god, money. Nothing against money, but money? No. I know what it does to people. Actually, I wanted to jumpstart an economy based on retrieving metals from waste so that we didn't have to destroy lands and peoples for ore. In our college days, I promised Kranti on more than one drunken night that I would change the world. But I've been sober since, drunk only on the tragic poetry of life. And here we are, on the verge of discovery. Kranti suspects that we have discovered a form of life so alien that we can barely recognize it. She gave me some technical stuff about orthogonal Walker indices and negative subzones of phase space. But what it boils down to is that there are, possibly, at least two life forms on Shikasta B. One is Avi, or what he has become. How to explain Avi? It is a task nearly as impossible as explaining you. To explain Avi and Bhimu, to explain them is to go back in time to you and me. But where to begin? Perhaps it should be the time you lent me your battered copy of Jagdish Chandra Bose's Response in the Living and the Non-Living. It was somewhere between Ambedkar and Darwin, I think. You had been pushing books on me. My English and Hindi were both improving. My head was singing with ideas, a magnificent incoherence within which my slowly awakening mind wandered, intoxicated. From my mother's simplistic dreams for me, which I had unconsciously adopted, a good job and reasonable wealth, freedom from want, your usual middle-class unexamined life, from that you took me to a place that whispered, "The universe is larger than this." I remember the exact moment I opened the book and Bose's dedication leapt out at me, "To my fellow countrymen," as though the great scientist had himself touched my hand across time. I knew already that he was anti-caste, that he had the ability to walk away from fortune, and that his contributions had only been recognized decades after his death. But it was because of that book that I got really interested in metals. I decided then to go into metallurgy, even though the engineering program's chief objective was to produce mining engineers. Why not get to know the monster intimately? My real interest was in the mining of landfills, in reclamation of metals from electronic waste, but what caught my poetic imagination was the possibility that metals were alive, in some metaphorical sense, if not the literal. Bose's experiments on plants and metals under stress elicited similar responses. He had made some conceptually audacious suggestions that were laughed off or politely dismissed. Only in recent times, with the greatly increased understanding of plant sentience and communication, man, he would have loved mycorrhizal networks, have some of his ideas gained credence. But metals. We know that metals are not alive in the usual sense. Metals in their pure form allow for flow, just as living systems do. That we are all electrical beings, that life is electricity, is true enough, but not all electricity is life. Still, When I first started to learn about metals, I saw in my imagination the ions studded in an ever-surging sea of valence electrons, the metallic forms so macroscopically varied, silver and pale yellow, sodium, soft as butter against the hardness of steel, the variations in ductility and malleability, the way rigid ions succumbed to softness under heat. I saw all this. And I wanted to know metal, to know it for its own sake as much as for its practical use. That's how you really know anything, anyway. Between your mind and mine, yours trained in artificial intelligence, mine in metallurgy, Avi's predecessors were born, starting with Kabadiwala, made to find metal waste in trash dumps. Celebrating over Daru, we began to argue about ethics. Frousian models of value emergence in technological development, if I remember correctly. Somehow the notion came up of AI sentience, hotly debated for over a decade before us, as network intelligences started to pass the lowest level Turing tests. The AI protection clauses started to be invoked and applied. You said, to restrain a being, any being that is capable of sentience is to put a baby in a maximum isolation prison cell because you are afraid it will grow up a criminal. I argued that artificial intelligence was not like the baby, not human at all. It was alien, despite its human parents. Wasn't that why there were laws against the development of free AIs? For any AI system, there must be a balance between the freedom of complexity and the necessity of control. You looked at me with that intent, dark gaze and sighed. Don't you get it? The restraint protocols are about slavery, not ethics. The question is not whether or not we should build free AIs. The challenge is, having built one, how do you teach it how to be ethical? For whatever we mean by ethical. Thus, Avi's precursors came about. Experiments in the university's frigid AI development labs while the air burned outside. Finally, you came up with the idea that an AI capable of learning could only acquire an ethical compass the way children do. So you and I became parents to the robots that would eventually give birth to Avi. The final development took us from pre-Avi 187 to Avi and his conjoined twin, Bhimu. They were our babies. But you were the one who took Avi Bhimu home with you every night, took them to work, to classes, to demonstrations, to children's birthday parties. Avi Bhimu's Walker Index earned each of them an electronic person identity chip, but an EP is only the lowest common denominator among the top-class AIs. What we've done, what you did, really, is to create a new class of artificial intelligence altogether. An ultra-AI. Whether ultra-AIs are sentient in the way we understand it, we don't yet know. They are free to learn and grow, yet grounded in years-long ethical training resulting from close contact with the same group of humans. There are only two ultra-AIs in the entire universe. Avi and Bhimu. You might say the great WorldNet AIs, the distributed interweb intelligences, are just as complex and unpredictable, but Avi and Bhimu are so much closer to us, bound as they are in their metal ceramic bodies, with BioWare networks rather like our nerves. AIs are indeed alien. We know now we cannot download human consciousness into an AI because the physicality matters. But I have to admit that one of the reasons I can't spend more time in Immer with Avi is because every step he takes up a rock wall makes my heart jump like an over-worried parent. Now, I say now, despite the 4-year time lag, Avi's been behaving oddly. The reports he sends back are cryptic and terse. He is sending us images and data. But he stopped chatting, and his tone has changed. No explanation as to the odd dancing steps, no streaming feed of his thought process as he makes hypotheses and tests them, which he's designed to do. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it feels as though he is preoccupied. His neural activity is faster and more intense than we've ever recorded, which means he's learning at a prodigious rate. We've sent queries, of course, but we won't have the answers for another 8 years. So we must draw our own conclusions. I wish we had Bhimu with us to help us understand him.